Welcome to my monthly podcast series titled Becoming a Sage. My name is Jan Fried, but you can call me Dr. Jan. I blog about leading, living, and saging or conscious aging. I am passionate about helping people get from where they are to where they want to be, particularly in the second half of life. I also say I'm out to retire the word retirement. We're not retiring, but we're moving on to something else, and I believe it takes time and intentional thought to successfully move on to what's next in life. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Michelle Silver, who is an associate professor at the University of Toronto with joint appointments in the Department of Sociology and the Interdisciplinary Center for Health and Society. Dr. Silver's primary areas of research include work, aging and retirement, health, information seeking, and perceptions about aging and health. Her book, Retirement and Its Discontents, was published in 2018 by Columbia University Press. For more information on Michelle, please refer to the bio attached to this podcast. Welcome to Becoming a Sage series, Michelle. Is it okay if I call
Thank
you Michelle?
You.
Or would you prefer
Absolutely.
Dr. Silver?
No, Michelle's great.
Michelle.
Thank you so much.
Well, great. Well, I read your book on a recent vacation, and honestly, I wanted to underline almost every line because it resonated so perfectly with not only my own experience, but my current work of trying to help people and organizations prepare for what's next. And so I'm thrilled to be able to interview you today. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk with you today.
Well, I've just got a few questions here, and since I just finished reading your book, what led you to research retirement and to even write this book?
So when I was in my very early 20s, my father developed dementia, and my father was significantly older than my mom. So I had always sort of been introduced to, issues about aging, really at a very early point in my life. But when he developed dementia, it was really clear that, that he needed to essentially retire. And so he had a practice with, lots of patients and lots of files. And, while my siblings really took on the lion's share of the work with regard to like reaccommodating, his home space, and making decisions there, I ended up, we divided and conquered, and I ended up closing up his practice and literally, ended up, going in and working with the landlord, getting rid of the furniture, shredding the files, and literally locking the door for the last time to his office, which had, really been a source of comfort to his patients for many, many, many decades, and had also been a source of identity for him. And I think because he had dementia, he really wasn't able to fully comprehend what was happening. And, that was the reason why it wasn't possible for him to keep working. And I think I might have internalized some of the impact of what was going on, obviously with regard to the personal front, but with regard to the work front as well. And so it sort of gave me pause, not only for everything else that was going on, but because it really made me think about, wow, this is a huge change for, his patient's life, for his own life, this is a huge adjustment that this is just sort of like fast forwarding through. And so when I went on and was deciding to do dissertation work and, graduate studies, I found myself really drawn to thinking about retirement. And, it was a little bit ironic, like as I was getting my career started, I found myself really asking questions about, what was the impact of retirement? And like, long story short, I ended up doing a series of econometric studies where I was looking at data points and studying retirement trajectories. And eventually I started to want to just talk to people, and I did some qualitative training and found myself asking questions like, what does it mean to be retired? What's the impact for individuals
Michelle?
and also for society. Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of faded out there a little bit. So I kind of lost you when it went to, you learned about qualitative studies, because that's kind of the research method that I use for my work too.
Oh, sure. So I was just saying that my training had originally been to study econometric models of retirement, had been quantitative, but I found myself becoming really interested in more of the why and how and what does this mean to people. I had, you know, definitions of retirement that had been used for decades by economists that, you know, had to do with hours worked and very, you know, and amounts paid, and then you receive no compensation and you're not working any hours, and suddenly that defines you as being retired. And so I started to really want to ask questions about what it meant to people to be retired and how they felt about the word, about the transition, about what it meant, because I saw all these assumptions being made about retirement. And so my interest went from sort of the personal experience with my father to the experience of, you know, analyzing data, and then just wanting to understand, getting a sense that retirement has huge implications, and looking at the numbers and the data and the numbers of people that are transitioning into an age group where society sort of suggests, if not imposes, that one should stop working. But yet I can see there's a tremendous amount of people moving into this sector that, you know, potentially have a lot to offer and are potentially being overlooked because of ageist assumptions and out-of-date norms.
I totally agree. And I could not, honestly, I couldn't agree more in terms of people still have so much to offer. And I really agreed with your ageist assumptions, and we have to push back is what I think. So no, that's really, really fascinating. You interviewed people from five occupations, CEOs, doctors, athletes at the top of their game, professors, which I related to because I was a professor for 30 years and now I'm an adjunct professor in a graduate program, and homemakers, which was very fascinating. What are some of the challenges that retirement created for them?
So although this group sound really different, right? There's, you know, some, you can kind of maybe make associations quickly between any two pairs, but overall they seem quite different. But what really unified them was that they closely identified with what they considered to be their life's work, whether they were paid, you know, in the top 1% or whether they were paid nothing at all, right? Like in the case of the CEOs at 1% and in the case of the homemakers where they were not paid for their work. Each of them really closely identified with their life's work. And so when they transitioned out of it, either because they were forced to or because they just sort of went along with ageist assumptions that they should be done, or whether they really truly felt like that it was something that they wanted to do, each of them shared a sense of discontent in that they sort of felt a bit rejected and cast aside. And so I think your question was like, what can we learn from their experience? Is that right?
Or what were some of the challenges that, you know, retirement created for them?
Okay. So the challenges that they all felt was this sort of sense of feeling ungrounded. You know, many of them had followed, you know, a pretty strict schedule or at least a regular routine Monday through Friday or whatever their work hours were. And so, you know, to have that, you know, no longer part of their week, was really unsettling. You know, many of them said, you know, now all of a sudden every day is a Sunday. And that was something they hadn't quite, you know, that some of them had actually thought would be wonderful. And what makes them distinct then, you know, like all of humanity or, you know, a general population, was that this group of people
didn't feel that it was a luxurious time and, you know, a great time to go for walks on the beach and cruises. And, you know, some of them did that for a short period of time, mm-hmm. but they just felt that it wasn't quite what they wanted to do with their life. And many of them had retired because that was when their father did. Mm-hmm. I heard over and over, like, you know, well, my father, he retired. And it wasn't always 65, wasn't always the magic number. Some of them had, you know, alternative numbers in their head, but it really quite often had to do with what their father had done. And sometimes it was because their father died, you know, retired and then died the next year. And they wanted to, you know, do more. But the fact is that we are living in remarkable times. Mm-hmm. People are living longer than they have in all of human history. And so the odds are that if your father's the model of retirement, that you're really unlikely to follow that. You're unlikely to retire in quite the same way because you're much more likely to have a longer life expectancy, mm-hmm. to live longer. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of the people that I interviewed were sort of living with these anachronistic expectations about what their retirement would be like. And then once they came to realize that they were kind of out of date, then they started to want more out of life and recognize they had a lot more to give.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excellent. No, that's true. And, you know, a theme that came through, you know, over and over, and you're kind of alluding it to it, is the lack of purpose, you know, really meaning. What do they want to, they really felt lost. And I love the stories and the quotes that you included in the book in terms of how lost they really felt. And as you said, it didn't matter. That was kind of across the board.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, the narratives in your book, they highlight the tensions that emerge in the transition to retirement, you know, between what's gained and what's lost. You know, for instance, like you talk about freedom versus structure. How did the people you interviewed struggle with those tensions, and how did some, you know, what was some of the work they did to reconcile them?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, right. Most of what I sort of share in terms of their narratives is about that struggle, is mm-hmm. about that feeling that, for example, many of the physicians I interviewed would describe for me how their work brought not only a sense of personal identity, you know, like the doctor in mm-hmm. front of their name, but a sense of really connecting to humanity, to, you know, that sense of purpose and of making a meaningful impact on people's lives. And so going from, you know, doctor to retired doctor, it sort of like removed this component of what they had in them, what they were capable of accomplishing as a person. And that sort of tension between this, you know, expected freedom that, you know, retirement in quotes promises, it wasn't quite as satisfying as what they had expected. And so, you know, that's why the book is called Retirement and Its Discontents, mm-hmm. because it's really a play on Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, where, you know, he suggests that in society we have this sort of contrast between an individual's quest for freedom and societal norms actually restrict our primitive instincts to you know in Freud's case, he's talking about, you know, to commit adultery or to injure or, you know, hurt other people, that we do have these sort of instincts and we agree to live in a civil society, and that makes us all safer. And I think retirement is this really sort of overlooked construct that we sort of impose and assume that this, you know, huge group of like baby boomers right now are sort of entering into that traditional retirement age. And we sort of assume that it's a welcome catch-all phrase. But I really think that the fact of the matter is that it's a bad word for a lot of people.
I totally agree.
Something to be, you know, to be avoided at all costs. And, you know, I mean, it's very convenient, I think, within the financial planning sector, because in that case, it quickly identifies something that you need to be saving for, And that's really important, right? It's really important that we all have a financial safety net around us. And retirement does serve that sort of a purpose, which is to say, like, you know, hey, you need to plan financially for your future and actually physically as well. Like, mm-hmm. we need to plan for that later stages in the life course when, you know, like the odds are we're more likely to be frail. And so therefore we need to overcompensate and prepare, you know, and not be thrown off guard because that can happen mm-hmm. and is more likely to, you know, I'm wholly against fear mongering, but I do think that being prepared in the realm of financial, the realm of physical, and the realm of emotional is very, very important. But otherwise, I think that the term is really has quite negative implications. And the people I interviewed were really about sort of showing, illustrating the ways that, you know, making assumptions that everybody wants to retire or should can be damaging.
Exactly. And, you know, that's why I say I'm kind of out to retire the word retirement because, you know, we're moving on and we're going to be doing something. But I think what your book points out is so many people feel like they still want to contribute and many organizations are not allowing them to do that.
Yes.
So I definitely agree with that. Well, there was something real interesting in your book about retirement parties.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is I tend to be an advocate for these retirement parties because of the ritual it kind of plays in transitioning. And are you familiar with the work of William Bridges on transitions?
Not specifically.
Yeah, well, you might look at his work because he's really one of the experts. Now, again, I interviewed him for my leadership book. I had a leadership book come out in 2013. And but he has also died, which makes me sad. But William Bridges, and he's really like the expert on transitions. And he wrote one book called The Way of Transitions. I think he wrote another one, Job Transitions. But even communities will use his work as communities try to evolve and transition from one kind of stage to another. And in his book, or in his work, I should say, he talks a lot about he breaks it down into endings, and mm-hmm. then what he calls neutral zone, and then beginnings. And mm-hmm. he said, we don't begin something until we end something. And but most people don't like the neutral zone. So they'd rather, you know, quickly, you know, I mean, he kind of said that's why people kind of have affairs or that's why they go from one job, you know, to another job, you know, and it could be a bad job, you know, just because they don't want to be alone or they don't want to be in that neutral zone. And so the reason why I'm bringing this up is because, you know, if someone is really going to retire, I really advocate, then let's celebrate. Now, it doesn't have to be a huge party, but some way of appreciating the work that has been done. And I know in your book that, you know, you share several stories where, and I think it has to do with how the retirement party takes place. Because it can seem like a death or a funeral or because that's that ending part. Something is ending. That's true. But mm-hmm. I think to celebrate, you know, helps people move on to what's next instead mm-hmm. of just have them disappear, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, in your book, I remember there were, you know, several stories where several people had several retirement parties. And
that's right.
And that they just didn't find satisfaction from that. And so I think, again, I think it depends on how well it's kind of like I've gone to funerals that I leave feeling, you know, really like that was a great funeral. And I've gone to funerals that I left thinking that didn't help at all, you know. So I think it's how it's done. But I've been a very big advocate just because of that ritual part and celebrating what somebody has contributed. Anyway, I just kind of wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I am all for party anytime, any excuse, right? Uh-huh. In academia, we're notorious for never, ever pausing to sort of reflect on positive accomplishments. There's just, it's very, just rarely happens,
yeah,
right?
I can relate. I can relate.
Yeah. Yeah. So yes, I'm very much of the mindset that if there is something positive, that we really should focus as much energy as we can on that. So I definitely agree with that. I was in my book, I was my, in my work, I've been very much inspired by the work of, Dr. Joel Savinsky, and he has written about the ritual of the retirement party, taking very much an anthropological perspective and focusing on the ritual of it and the interesting place that it puts a person in particular, the sort of liminal stage that retirement and in particular the retirement party is, because unlike a funeral, which sort of marks a person's end, a retirement party is really about the transition, like as you mentioned. And I will certainly focus on William Bridges' work.
I think you'd find it very helpful to your work.
Yeah, I'm sure. I was particularly inspired by the retirement party as a touch point. And so in my methodology, I always asked about that as a touch point to you know, as a way of sort of being consistent across the participants that I interviewed. And what was striking about this unique subset was that, as you pointed out, their experiences were a bit different than what you might expect in terms of, you know, they didn't really find it to be a celebration unanimously. And many of them had multiple parties. And, you know, it wasn't just like this one sort of traditional ritual. There were some, in particular, one of the participants described his retirement party as akin to being at his own funeral. And literally he was listening to people describe, you know, his accomplishments in ways that made him feel like he was gone already. And he even had people who were sort of like describing how they were going to take over. And he was, you know, it's just so off-putting, even though it was, you know, there was cake and there was balloons and, you know, there was all the touch points of a celebration. But to him, it felt it didn't sit right. And you know, of course, like there are many, many people that are can't wait to retire and that love their retirement parties. But here, you know, what I was hearing with this particular subset was that it was really a turning point for them that helped them recognize, wait a minute, I'm not done yet. Like all these people in the room, half the people in this room might think I'm done, but I've got a lot more in me. And the retirement party actually helped them come to that realization and became a turning point where they said, actually, now I'm going to focus on this, whether it was a subset of their previous work or a new kind of work or a volunteer work or whatever it was. It was a real turning, personal turning point.
Well, you know, another question I had from reading your book is, did you find any difference between, because you include women, you include both women and men as professionals, especially the homemakers. But I mean, you had women, I think you had women doctors. And I mean, you know, you definitely, did you find a difference? Maybe not in these interviews, but in some of your earlier stages of research, when you were looking at other data points in terms of differences between men and women. And the reason why I'm asking that is because I think society in general allows women more freedom. I think women can find an identity kind of easier and faster than many men. And what I say, you know, and an example I often use, I say, you know, I could call up somebody, you know, female friend and say, let's go to the movies, let's go out to dinner. And where men will play golf, they'll play tennis, you know, they might have power lunches, but they're not as likely to call up someone. In fact, I've been reading a lot and blogging about, you know, men need more friends, you know, in terms of, you know, men are competitive. And I don't know, I just wondered if you saw any difference where overall, maybe not in these interviews for the book, but in some of your previous research, where women that women do have an kind of an easier transition than men? I don't know.
Yeah. So outside of the research of the book, what I've observed is that there are quite a number of social sort of clubs and groups and mm-hmm. ways that women tend to participate in ways that, yeah, that are maybe more inviting. Mm-hmm. But I think some of that has to do with the numbers. Like some of that has to do with the fact that women have a longer life expectancy than men in almost every country around the world. There's like a handful where men have a longer life expectancy, and it's very easily explained by oppressive mm-hmm. political regimes. And so I think that, you know, it's, you know, there are more women in later stages. And of course it has to do with the sort of work opportunities that were afforded to women as they were coming of age. And so the, you know, current group of women in this group that you're talking about, it may be something that they're simply more familiar with because of the fact that they didn't have the opportunities to be paid for their work, they were more likely to, you know, develop a group of friends or to be comfortable with that idea of not putting on a suit and being at work or whatever mm-hmm. kind of work an individual does. But, you know, but that said, I think that there are more and more groups of men who do get together for, brunch groups and different types of, you know, sporting activities you mentioned. And I expect that we will see more of that, particularly as the sort of life expectancy gap between men and women sort of narrows. I think that it's more likely, but not necessarily for everybody. Mm-hmm. I think there are a subgroup of men and women that just really identify with their work as something that defines them as a person, that they are a productive person, or they are, you know, a person who gives and who wants to be connected with others in a way that, you know, has outcomes and is, you know, potentially even tangible, like in the case of healthcare workers, where, you know, their work means actually helping someone feel better or survive. Mm-hmm. And so, going back to my research, what I observed was that there were remarkable similarities between the men and the women that I interviewed in terms of the ways that they identified with their work, like I said, as a mm-hmm. source of personal connection in terms of who they were. And that was very interesting. Of course, you know, this is a subset, there are many women who just simply didn't have the opportunities that men did to participate in the workforce when they were coming of age. And so, but this particular subset of women of people that I interviewed tapped into those women who did have the experiences. And many of them, you know, the women in particular described a lot of self-sacrifice that they had mm-hmm. to give up in terms of development of their own personal interests or of not having their own families because of their work. And here I'm thinking about the women who were CEOs who I interviewed. Mm-hmm. Several of them explained to me, you know, I decided that wasn't going to be for me having a family or some married but decided I'm not going to have kids, that sort of thing. That they were not necessarily forced into it, but it was something that they did feel that it was a, you know, this or that, and they were interested in their work to the extent that that dominated much of their childbearing years. Mm-hmm. So
no, that's true.
So that's how it played out, and you know, not necessarily regretfully, but that's how it played out, So for them, you know, I think their experiences with retirement were very similar mm-hmm. to the other participants.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, at one point in my research work, I was interviewing college presidents. And at that time, women college presidents were typically single, you know, either never married or divorced, and just really could not, it was very difficult to kind of combine family with that if you really wanted to be at the highest level, because you have to move around a lot. And yes. So anyway, that's interesting. Well, very good, Michelle. Okay. You make such a strong case about why it's important to understand the discontents about retirement. And I actually just find that all very fascinating. You do a very good job in the introduction explaining exactly who you interviewed, you know, in terms of, you know, these were people not happy with retirement. And you advocate confronting ageist assumptions. Again, I totally agree with your conclusions. My focus is on helping people prepare for this non-financial or the emotional aspect of retirement in hopes of helping people be more content with this phase of life. What could or should organizations do to help prepare people? Or why should organizations invest in people who will be leaving?
Okay. I mean, I think that's very, very important work. And I think in terms of helping people prepare, I mean, first of all, just opening it up for conversation is a refreshing start, because so many people are just so used to focusing on their early career transitions and moving up, you know, mm-hmm. into their positions. And then they're just sort of like given a piece of paperwork, or sometimes it's so subtle as a paperwork comes on their desk about, you know, how certain benefits are going to be transitioned. And there's almost no conversation about anything else, you know, like in terms of the fact that this means their schedule will be different, or even conversations about what does the person want to do? Because I believe that if employers would take the time to talk to employees about what their interests are, they might find that people are interested in transitioning in unique ways that are creative, that are maybe different than what the employer would have imagined, and they might have tremendous benefits in ways that for the employer turn out to help extend institutional memory about, you know, within the organization. Sometimes workers will say, well, actually, I would like a different type of schedule. And if employers could adjust, there could be tremendous benefits. Because often I hear employers say, well, you know, like to keep a worker at the end of their, you know, at the what they assume to be the end, mm-hmm. but at later stages is so expensive. And the truth is, it doesn't have to be expensive in the way that, you know, is traditionally thought of. In fact, it can be extraordinarily valuable so long as you sit down with the employee and figure out what's the schedule that makes the most sense to that individual, and what are the ways that they feel like they can contribute. So I guess what I would recommend in terms of helping people prepare from the employer's perspective is that they take the time to let the employee think about what they want to do, what they think they're best at, and they have a conversation that also, I think they will find in many, many cases, can be aligned with what the long-term interests of the organization are, which is usually about sustaining and retaining information. And you know, of course, there's the idea that, you know, training and mentoring of newer employees, but I really believe that there's much more that mature workers have to offer, especially when you narrow it down to people who want to keep working, who are passionate about what they do, because in that way, mature workers are a unique, you know, there's a unique subset there that is not only skilled, but also has experience, and then is also motivated and wants to keep working. You can't really say that of any other age group. Every age group has people who are not very skilled, or who has people who are, you know, not very interested in what they're doing, doesn't really care, does a bad job, whatever. Every age group has that. But what's really unique about mature workers is that those who are, you know, in this subcategory that we're talking about, that are motivated and want to keep working, and it's mutually beneficial for the organization, I really believe it's a no-brainer that organizations should pause and adjust and rethink the ways that they communicate with employees about their later career transitions.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. No, that's true. And again, that kind of goes back to those assumptions again, those. Well, I always like to ask, what else should I have asked you that our listeners need to know? What other words of wisdom on this topic do you want to share?
I always want to make the disclaimer that I know that there are so many people out there who can't wait to retire. And I just I wish them all the best. I mean, you know, my book happens to be about a subgroup of people for whom it was not a positive experience. And there are many wonderful books out there about the wonderful things that people do outside of work. Mm-hmm. When they, you know, phase into later stages of adulthood. And so when I give talks, I try to share as many of those because I think that's so important. And I, you know, I hate to be like, I'm not a downer, I recognize that some of my message is about shedding light on this subgroup of people who just had so much to contribute and were sort of overlooked. And that message, I felt very strongly that message needed to be shared and that it wasn't out there in the literature. But I always want to say that when I get a chance to connect, you know, personally with someone like you. And I guess the other point I would say is about the physical aspects of later life transitions and just the, you know, I just interviewed so many people who spent so much of their life sitting at a desk and giving and giving and giving. And much of it meant physically and, you know, not necessarily like physical laborers, because there's great books about, you know, those sort of the experiences and the importance of what happens among workers who are, you know, in manual labor and their later career transitions and financial challenges. But I interviewed a lot of people who were quite sedentary and had given and given and given and didn't take a lot of time to even just take a lunch break, you know? Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing I think is really important to just remember that, you know, like it's important to practice for later life transitions, whatever they may be. And some of that means like practice taking a lunch break, practice moving more, like going for walks during lunch or whatever. Or, you know, whenever you think of it, because there does come a point, for many people, especially people who've been very sedentary, when it's not so easy to do it if you haven't been practicing doing it. And, you know, being physically mobile is really something not to take for granted. You know, not everybody can, you know, not everybody is able to move. And so I just say like the extent to which it's possible to just keep moving in whatever way is possible is just really important for people to remember. And, you know, my book here is just, it's all about, the sort of work identity. And the other, you know, and then when people lose that, how difficult it is. But I really think the same can be said for moving, and because when physical mobility becomes limited, that is a real challenge and a loss that, you know, hopefully if we live long enough, we can minimize that, those sort of losses, or embrace the sort of physical challenges that we have, but with our fullest self available to it.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. Well, Michelle, you've given us so much to think about. I really thank you. And the emphasis in this series is on learning how to make the rest of life the best of life. So may the rest be the best for you.